listening to Fiercely Independent, KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org. Radio powered by the people.
I'm Lila Garrett. Next on Connect the Dots, we're joined by Nobel Peace Prize nominee David Swanson to discuss our impending invasion of Venezuela and the apparent congressional acceptance of it, as well as their acceptance of the impending gigantic defense budget. And we introduce Live from the Front Lines, a dynamic new grassroots organization dedicated to reforming our neighborhood environments. And Jackie Goldberg, school board candidate, gives us the real results of the teachers' strike. All about the rise of the grassroots, coming up right now on Connect the Dots.
Let's move the world to a better place. A world without war, a world without race, a world where our leaders follow our will, not where we let them convince us to kill. Let's move the world to a better place, a world with a future we're happy to face, a world without gods that never existed, a world where the truth will not be resisted.
Welcome to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Lila Garrett, still reeling from the cheap, manipulative speech the president had the nerve to spew at his State of the Union address. We've seen vulgar exploitation of ordinary Americans before. Like a real showman, he sprinkled his speech with new American heroes, the veteran who survived World War II, the astronaut who made it to someplace in space, I forget where, the cop who got shot in the line of duty. All gave nice punctuation to a basically terrifying promise of America's future. What did Trump really say? Well, while promising to make America great again, his code for making America white again, he memorialized his searing bigotry, strengthening his description of immigrants as murderers and drug dealers, branded the world's democratic elected leaders like Maduro of Venezuela, and substituted him with the American-educated corporate flunky Guaido, reaffirmed America's right to interfere in world governments with impunity, warned those countries who resisted our mandates with corporate punishment, and bragged about his stellar accomplishments, among which was winning a $700 billion defense budget last year. And in mid-cheering of our Congress of Robots, he promised a $716 billion defense budget this year. Let's pause for a moment. How much is $700 billion? It is not just the largest war budget in the history of the world. It does not just give the military power over every department in government. It is not just a positive potential investment in education, health, clean air, justice, equality, or any other life-affirming program. It's the opposite. A $700 billion defense budget is a mega warning to the world. Do things our way or starve, suffer, and die. And it is not just directed at our so-called enemies, those ruled by dictatorships such as Russia, China, and North Korea, to mention a few. It is directed at our so-called allies, NATO. You remember NATO. It consists of Albania, Belgium, Bulgaria, Croatia, Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, France, Germany, Greece, Hungary, Iceland, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Montenegro, Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Romania, and Slovakia, Slovenia, Spain, Turkey, the United Kingdom, and, are you ready for this? Canada. Do it our way, or we impose sanctions on you that will watch your people go like they have in Yemen, plagued by disease and terror, with no place to run. Millions will wither and watch their children wither. Yemen, a small country of 28 million people, with half, 14 million, victims so far of these attacks, or dead in an epidemic of starvation, cholera, and relentless bombing because of our sale to Saudi Arabia of $100 billion worth of arms. It is so savage that the Republican Senate is now asking the savage in the White House to stop sending those arms to the Saudis. And what has Trump's response been? Very simple. And this is a quote. No, it's too good a deal. End quote. A war budget of almost $1 trillion, and yet of all the issues that the Democrats opposed in that terrifying State of the Union address, not one word confronted the elephant in the room, or should I say, the plague in the room, the military budget. $700 billion could wipe out poverty, not just in our country, but according to our first guess, poverty on the planet. It could guarantee Medicare for all. It could do the most miraculous thing of all, bring the economy closer to equality than it has ever been in history. With all of that, not a word about the military budget was mentioned in the media critique after that obscene speech. The press caught the lies, the hate, the mawkish patronizing of American heroes, the vulgar bragging about himself. The press caught all that, but they were silent on the military budget. If it's about violence, invasion, war, the Congress, and that includes both parties and both houses, stand and applaud. Why? Because they know one thing. Our number one industry is and always has been war. War, one stranger killing another stranger for the power and profit of a third stranger. That third stranger is far too often us. Our number one industry is arms. 60% of our budget goes toward it. Arms. The industry that has neither friends nor enemies, only customers. That is our major industry. That is something to be ashamed of. Today we're going to begin our interviews with an American who has devoted his life to making this country admit that. He is David Swanson. David Swanson is an author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He's the director of worldbeyondwar.org and campaign coordinator for rootsaction.org. His books include War is a Lie. He blogs at davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org, and he hosts Talk Nation Radio. He is a 2015, 16, and 17 Nobel Prize Peace nominee. So, David Swanson, it has been much too long that we have spoken to you, but we're very glad to have you back with us. So we're pre-recording this as we pre-record most of our shows, and this is the day after the speech by the leader of the free world, and we know who, unfortunately, that is. So what did you think of Trump's speech last night?
Well, I think a lot of the world is more free than people in the United States. They just don't scream about freedom as much. I thought it was, of course, reprehensible. I could not bring myself to watch it all. I did read it all. But the few things I agreed with, you know, are right beliefs that he holds for the wrong reasons and doesn't act on. You know, he says he wants to end wars in Syria and Afghanistan. We'll do so already. Congress hasn't actually prevented him from doing so. You know, the bulk of the speech was, again, demonizing anyone who lives south of the United States border. You know, the same fascist, racist redirection of everybody's animosity that was part of his campaign. I think it's disgraceful and impeachable.
The disgraceful part we've already concentrated on, and this is a man who is living in disgrace and doesn't even know it. But the impeachable part is a big question. What do you think is going to happen? Impeachment, as you pointed out to me in previous conversations, is really up to the House of Representatives, and they have an overwhelming Democratic majority. You think they're going to impeach Trump?
Well, I've spent decades refusing to make any predictions, not just because I'm no good at it, but also because I don't think it's the role of an activist. I look at what needs to be done and might conceivably done and then try to make it happen. And so I think we have a moral responsibility to try to get Trump impeached and removed from office, despite the fact that there are a handful of things here and there that we agree with him on. The world is a complicated place. And I think it's important to understand the history of impeachment and the fact that numerous judges and senators and cabinet members have been impeached and removed from office. And there have been numerous campaigns toward impeachment, including hearings in the House of Representatives about impeachment that haven't made it all the way to impeachment, but have still done a world of good. And so if the House of Representatives holds hearings, public hearings, top-rated television, as Trump might understand it, to go over legitimate impeachable offenses by Trump and in some cases by Pence as well, and then sends it to the Senate for a trial, this is not going to be the same country it was before those hearings. And even if Trump is removed and Pence survives, which is the great horror of all the don't impeach Trump crowd, you know, apart from those on the extreme right, he would be a weaker president even than Gerald Ford, who was so weakened by Nixon's impeachment or Nixon's almost impeachment. Again, it wasn't necessary to get to impeachment with Nixon. He packed up and left. So I think the danger here is in allowing Trump a free hand to lawlessly do anything he pleases with a guarantee that he won't be impeached.
David Swanson, I want to go back to a statement that you made before this last statement, and that is there are a number of things that we agree with him on. Let's discuss that. We agree with him that we should withdraw our troops from Syria. We agree with him that we should withdraw our troops from Afghanistan. But we do not agree with the fact that we have a $700 billion defense budget that we just paid the Defense Department last year, and that this year Trump intends to make it $716 billion, sums that really would end poverty in the United States or come very close to it. And the question is, why is he suddenly interested in withdrawing troops from Syria, in your opinion? If he's doing the right things for the wrong reasons, what are his reasons in Syria?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that he's not doing it. He's talking about doing it,
and he needs to actually do it.
And if he does, I will applaud it, regardless of what crazy reasons may have driven it. I don't think it's so sudden. He talked this way during the campaign and ever since, as well as sometimes talking in the opposite way. He's not a consistent guy. But he claims to want to pull troops out of Syria and out of Afghanistan, and the Congress, to the extent it's done anything, has pushed back against that, but has not blocked it. Congress, meanwhile, claims it wants to pull U.S. military out of the war on Yemen, and Trump says he'll veto that. There's several other wars the U.S. is engaged in that apparently the president and Congress are both fine with. I'm against all the wars, regardless of who's with me. Now, what Trump says, if he weren't elected, the U.S. would be at war with North Korea. There's no way to prove that or argue that. It's a theoretical non-history. But to the extent that he's for peaceful overtures toward North Korea rather than threatening to nuke it as he used to do, and Congress is against him and Congress is trying to prevent pulling any U.S. troops out of South Korea ever, I'm on the side that Trump's on that one. But when it comes to the budget, which Congress and Trump have collaborated on radically increasing beyond its already obscene levels, I'm again against a lot of them. And it is, by the way, enough to end poverty on this planet, not just, you know, for this little 4% of humanity. You could end starvation with 3% of U.S. military spending, starvation in the world. That's the kind of money we're talking about. It kills more people by being diverted from good things than through the wars it pays for. So I'm against that, regardless of who's for it or against it.
That's a very important point that you just made. That the $700 billion that we gave last year to the War Department could end poverty on the planet. And the $716 billion that he's promised to give them this year could end poverty on the planet and on Mars. So it is a sickening and revolting thing that we have our priorities so mixed. But I think we should look a little bit into why he even talks about ending war in Syria. If we walk out of Syria, Russia prevails. We understand that. We walk out of Afghanistan, they said already that they are going back in. They've already said that. He is friendly with North Korea because he's so much like its dictator. And they both want to continue to develop nuclear weapons, as we know. And that's the deal that Trump is trying to make now with Russia. So there are all kinds of examples of why he wants to do the right thing for the wrong reasons. And one of those things is, well, I think that in this case, he wants to do the wrong things for the wrong reasons. But what about his desire to take over Venezuela? What's that about?
Well, I think it's important to at least have a little context that your listeners, Lila, probably have more than other people. But the United States has 800 to 1,000 bases outside of its borders in 80-some countries belonging to other people, has got troops in at least 175 countries, almost the whole earth. Russia has a military base in Syria. Stop. Right. So if Russia gets to keep its military base in Syria and the United States allows Syria to be one of a handful of spots on Earth that doesn't have a U.S. military base, then Russia wins. Russia prevails. Russia defeats us. Well, maybe, but I'm not particularly concerned that Russia is thereby dominating the globe. I think it's also important to note that Russia is adamantly opposed to the coup that Trump is trying to orchestrate in Venezuela. Russia is adamantly opposed to almost everything that Trump does, to blocking Russian energy deals in Europe, to putting weapons in Ukraine, to expanding NATO, to putting missiles in Poland and through Eastern Europe, to tearing up the Iran deal, to withdrawing from the INF treaty, to opposing criminalizing weapons in space or cyber attacks, and on and on and on. If Trump is a servant of Russia, he is the worst servant of anyone in the history of the world. And so for people who are both claiming that Trump obeys Putin and that it's necessary to support Trump in overthrowing the government of Venezuela, there is a contradiction to be dealt with, right? Because the last thing Russia wants is for the United States to install its puppet in the country with the most oil on earth.
Well, we don't entirely agree about this. I believe that he does most of what he does in concert with Russia. That includes the new determination to rebuild our stockpile of nuclear weapons. He says he wants to speak to Putin about it. He hopes they can make an arrangement, but he's not sure they can. My guess is they already have. And in terms of Yemen, when the Congress has said to him, we've killed or destroyed or starved 14 million people in Yemen, there are only 28 million people in the whole country. So you can say that we have basically destroyed the lives of half of the country just so far. Let's get out of there and let's stop sending them arms. And Trump's reaction, almost his exact words were, they paid us $110 billion for those arms and we have more coming. It's too big a deal to give up. Those were his words. It's too big a deal to give up.
So the first one, Lila, about the INF treaty, Russia has been consistently and publicly and adamantly opposed to the United States pulling out of the INF treaty. If that's a pretense, it's an extremely elaborate one. On the second one, I don't see any connection to Russia whatsoever. Russia doesn't want Saudi Arabia buying lots of weapons from the United States. What interest?
No, I didn't include Russia's interest in Yemen at all. That wasn't included. But I do think that the other things that he has done, he doesn't make a move without being in concert with Russia.
No, you really have. Believes, but I've yet to see an actual example of it.
Well, I think that we have seen an example of it. I think that he has been very defensive about Putin. And I think that it was a good thing, in a way, when he first got into office, that he spoke about Russia in a friendly way. He said it's a good thing for us to be friends of Russia's. And then for a while, we progressives believed that until we saw that the two countries were in concert with going into Syria and with the building of the arms race and so on. So we saw that that was no good either. But the big thing is, where do we go from here? What do we do about Venezuela? How can we influence our congresspeople not to go for this, not to send 5,000 troops to Colombia so they can go from there to invade Venezuela? that Maduro was a socialist. And what we do to countries that become socialist countries is we impose sanctions on them. And we get NATO to impose sanctions on them. And sanctions are very crippling things for nations. People don't realize that. They don't just include corn and crops and things of that kind. They include everything. And that's the problem that Maduro has had. And this new guy, Guaido, I learned from you, David Swanson, that he graduated from George Washington University. He's a corporate flunky. So our walking into Venezuela is for their oil, isn't it?
Clearly it is, and it's not speculation. It's what John Bolton openly says. It's for Venezuela's oil. Denmark is way more socialist than Venezuela, but it doesn't sit on the world's biggest supply of oil, and it doesn't try to maintain independence from the United States. The United States, as you say, has imposed harsh economic sanctions for the past dozen years and is now dangling aid to a country that it's starving. You know, as long as that aid is for its hand-picked puppets, yeah, straight from George Washington University, Washington, D.C. I think we take this understanding and these demands to every member of Congress, because there are very few exceptions. Both parties' leaders are on the wrong side on this, and we urgently demand that they change course. And at the same time, we take the opportunity that's being offered to us this week on Yemen, because Congressman Ro Khanna and Senator Bernie Sanders have reintroduced their bills to force a vote on getting the United States out of Yemen. And there are ridiculous loopholes in the bill. Trump has threatened to veto it, et cetera. But it is nonetheless going to be a huge step. If we can actually get Congress to try to end one war, then we can try to get it to end more wars and to prevent the initiation of other wars. So I think it's an opportunity not to be missed.
We completely agree about Yemen. We agree about that. Well, as progressives and as people who are horrified by our permanent war economy, and it is a war economy, and every year is starting to look more permanent and more insanely extravagant, what do we do about this? How do we find a progressive group that has the power to make the country understand that as long as we have this permanent war economy, we will never end war?
You know, we do have this handful of new, all women, all non-white, all Democratic members of Congress who have made brief statements here and there about moving the money out of the military. We need to push them to really become leaders on that and to include it in this idea of creating a Green New Deal. Why create a massive new program to protect the earth and not take the funding that's sitting there available out of one of the most environmentally destructive and otherwise destructive programs, namely militarism? You know, if you want to tax billionaires and corporations too, by all means. If you want to create public banks, wonderful. But take the money out of the militarism, because the money is just sitting there. And it's doing as much environmental damage there as it could anywhere else. So we've got to get some public leaders who can make it into corporate television on board with moving the money and ending this conversation about big government or small government and starting one about what kind of government.
Well, we are in complete agreement on this. We have to convert our economy or nothing really will change. And as I've said on other shows, that should be our top agenda. And so far it isn't. So far, most of the so-called progressive candidates for the next election, by the way, haven't even discussed foreign affairs. So it really is up to us to make that a number one agenda issue. And David Swanson, if anyone has tried to do that, it has been you. So thank you so much for your work and for joining us.
Same to you, Lila. We'll keep trying.
We'll keep trying. Thank you, David Swanson, for your consistent, uncompromising determination to make peace a more appealing, more profitable, and, if you will, more sexy subject than war. When our country and our Congress keep insisting that when we agree to kill strangers, as the Congress knows will happen in Venezuela, as in the past happened in Libya, Iran, as it happened when we liberated South Korea and Vietnam and all the others we still insist we liberated by murdering millions of their people and leaving them in a state of desperation and prey to more vicious dictatorships than they were opposing in the first place. When we stop lying to our people by describing every war as fighting for our country instead of what it really is, fighting for special interests that profit from it, and then finally, we may get it. I repeat, war is one stranger killing a second stranger for the power and profit of a third stranger. That's my mantra. I hope you will join me in it. It's amazing how much profit there is in negative activity, isn't it? We are finally admitting, for example, that the air we breathe is not only contaminated by our refusal to separate reckless profit from human survival, it isn't just the wars we wage for profit. It's the environment we abuse for the same reason. And on this subject, we are getting real people action. Not only has the Green New Deal just been introduced in Congress by Congressperson Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez and Senator from Massachusetts Ed Markey, if passed, it will switch us to become friends of the planet nature gave us instead of its enemy. And even more exciting, the people are beginning to take the subject of where we get our energy into their own hands. A unique group has formed, which calls itself Live from the Front Lines. I saw a short film that they're in the process of making. Nothing grandiose or remote. It's about real people like you and me and the results that the neighborhood air and water have on us when we leave it to the General Electrics of the world to take charge of our planet's energy. This is a new movement that we have a ground floor opportunity to join. And two of its leaders are with us today. They are Damian Luzo and Nayeli Kobo. Nayeli Kobo began her activism at the young age of 9. Now at the age of 18, she continues to fight tirelessly to end urban oil drilling and establish environmental justice. Nayeli's activism began when she was hospitalized as a result of living right across the street from a drilling operation in South L.A., which is owned by Allen Company and operates on land that is leased to the oil company by the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. And with us now is Damian Luzo, an environmental organizer and a former physics graduate who spent the majority of the last decade working to put an end to neighborhood drilling and fracking in California. Let's begin with Damian Luzo. Damian, welcome to Connect the Dots.
Hi, Lila. Thanks for having me here.
It's a pleasure. Damian is now an emerging documentary filmmaker and the co-founder of a new project called Live from the Front Lines. Well, let's find out exactly what that means. Okay, what does it mean?
Life on the Front Lines is a feature-length documentary film project that was created to lift up and amplify the voices of frontline community members throughout California who've been adversely impacted by neighborhood oil drilling and other forms of fossil fuel pollution. And the name Live from the Front Lines came just through conversation with community members and organizers working on this issue. I was trying to express how I wanted so badly for people to see what was happening right now, live from the front lines. And just in that sentence, you know, it was just like, that's it. We're going to call it Live from the Front Lines. And beyond just doing a documentary, we're doing live streams and we're doing short videos, trying to get word out about these issues immediately, trying to, in real time, let people know what's happening and to help to amplify the stories of folks that have been impacted.
Yeah, well, that was what appealed to me about it, that it became very personal, you know? And as we heard you speak and heard some of the victims that you were talking about speak, everyone in the room felt that this could happen to them. And very possibly is happening to them without their realizing it. And as an example of someone who was impacted personally by the impurities that we heap upon our people, We have Nayeli Kobo with us. She's a young woman whose activism began when she was hospitalized as a result of living right across the street from a drilling operation in South Los Angeles, which is owned by Allen Company and operates on land that is leased to the oil company by the Archdiocese. What a lofty name. What does Archdiocese mean in this case?
So basically what that means is that the church is leasing the land to the oil company. So I've always gone to a Catholic school. And when they do this, I just see them as hypocrites in the sense that they're choosing money over our community's health. They're choosing profit over people. And I've always gone to a Catholic school and they always tell us we need to protect God's creation. We need to love thy neighbor. And yet here they are doing the complete opposite.
Well, how were you impacted physically? It says here that you were hospitalized as a result of living right across the street from what the oil company was doing. They were obviously digging for oil. Tell us how they did that and why you weren't aware of it. I mean, did they cover the oil well with something, as they have done in my neighborhood? I live near Fox Studios, and they have oil wells all over the place in that particular part of the west side of Los Angeles. And it's supposed to be so fancy. And the truth is that those great majestic towers that are over them are really hiding poison. That's what's happening in my neighborhood. Is that what's happening in yours?
Yeah, and I'm really sorry to hear you have the same story, going through the same pain as my community. But that's what truly unites us in this fight, if that makes sense. So I grew up 30 feet across the street from an oil well called Alanco, and while they were operating, they were exposing toxic emissions that made not only me, but the rest of my community sick. So in my personal experience, I developed asthma, and that's something I'm always going to have to live with now. I got body spasms that got to the point where I couldn't walk. I had to be carried from one place to another. Yeah. I got nosebleeds that were so intense that I couldn't sleep horizontally. I had to sleep upright so I wouldn't choke on my own blood at night. And headaches that were so extreme, I had to get my MRIs done at the age of 9. And that's not a normal life for a young girl. And unfortunately, it wasn't just my reality. It was my community's reality. So that's what really inspired me to stand up and make a change in my community.
Well, tell us, where is your community exactly?
So I grew up in South LA around 23rd and Figueroa. Mm-hmm. I call it the sandwich between the USC and Staples Center.
And how do you know that your community was involved in this? I mean, what was your feeling before you connected it to the oil drilling? Was your feeling that there was an epidemic going on? You didn't know where it was coming from? How did you discover that it was attached to the oil drilling?
So Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles actually sent a toxicologist to come and speak to my community. And that's when we made the connection that hydrogen sulfide causes X, Y, and Z symptoms. And benzene causes X, Y, and Z symptoms. So that's when we truly made the connection and started organizing ourselves as a community. We created a grassroots campaign called People Not Bolsos, which translates to People Not Wells. And we started sharing our story. We started going to town hall meetings, to city hall hearings, sharing our story with different newspapers and such so we can make a change.
Helen Caldicott was the one who started Physicians for Social Responsibility. She's a good friend of mine, and she's done the world a great favor.
Yes.
It's too bad the world isn't more appreciative of it. And it's too bad that they didn't spend the last 40 years, really, trying to correct the situation more than they did trying to prosecute people like us who are trying to change it. But I think we're getting somewhere, and that's because of people like you and Damien. Now, Damien, you were an environmental organizer from the get-go, before you created Live from the Front Lines. What is an environmental organizer?
So I guess there's a lot of definitions for an environmental organizer, but it's someone who organizes people around issues that are very central to the world around us. So anything that's impacting the environment, the idea of organizing around that is getting people, one, informed on the issues that are happening, whether it's something that has global implications or something that's impacting them locally, and then finding out who are the people in power that we can put pressure on in order to see the change that we want. And then three, you know, being able to organize and develop tactics with that community to find out how to best move that person to get them onto your side.
Sounds like a work of love, and it's one person at a time that you're describing, isn't it?
Right.
And certainly one neighborhood at a time. Okay, so tell us how long you've been doing this, and how large has Live from the Front Lines become?
So as an environmental organizer, I have been doing this since I graduated from college. I was very much sprung into the political world. As soon as I graduated, there was not a lot of entry-level positions for me coming out of the recession. So I really just focused on learning, and I came across a lot more things about climate change and the environment. They were very much in connection with my love and study of physics in college. So really brought me to focus on that issue, and seeing that the scale of what was required in order to get the changes that we need, I realized that something had to be done through a political lens. We had to get something done politically in order to see the massive scale changes we need in order to save our planet.
So you managed to get a group together, and one thing led to another. And now you have an organization going that sounds to me like it has a big future. When you start talking to groups that are very official and so on, it's one thing. But when you start talking to individuals who've been impacted by these toxic problems, it becomes much more identifiable, much more serious. Tell us, how long has the organization existed, and how many people are involved? And then talk about your film.
Sure. So I would say Live from the Front Lines, it was really invented and came in inception in June of last year, 2018. And it really just came through a string of conversations with frontline community members throughout the years during my environmental organizing, and just driving through the fields of Kern County, where they've just got endless pump jacks as far as the eye can see. The person I drove with, his name's Elliot, he works on this film with me as well. And he would just say, Damien, like, people need to see what's happening. And I just heard that over and over from one friend after another and one community member after another, until it was like, you know what, next time I come out here, I'm going to bring a camera and we're going to get this going, and we're going to show the world what's happening in California, and we're going to expose California for the environmental racism that's taking place here, and the egregious fact that we are one of the only states in the United States with no setback limits, nothing to protect communities from oil and gas operations.
How quickly do you think you've grown? How many members do you have?
It's a completely grassroots group. I would say we've got about 20 people that I would call crew and team members. And then that extends way beyond when we're talking about folks that have been volunteering their time and helping us to start conversations with impacted community members. So I would say we're much bigger than just our team and our crew. And we're very much, every person that comes in as a new person to tell their story is not only just telling us their story, but they're telling us how they want their story to be told.
Right. And how many stories have you heard from how many people? That's my question, really.
Wow. So I would say we're probably somewhere between 50 and 100 people that we've spoken to. And we've gone to a lot of marches and rallies and events where we've heard from handfuls of people. And then we've had a lot of folks that we've been talking to that we've sat down and been speaking with for 4 hours at a time. So the idea is to hopefully have the opportunity to go in and truly invest this time in creating these stories.
So do you find that people are now looking for you as opposed to you looking for them? I mean, do you find that the organization is growing because there are that many people who have been impacted by the oil and so on?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that they're coming to us because of how many people have been impacted, because these things have been happening in people's backyards for a long time now. And, you know, a lot of people have come into communities and have talked with people like Nayeli. There have been a lot of folks that have come in and tried to tell this story or tried to report on what's happening. And I think what's different, and I would say very recently, there are a lot of communities coming up and definitely reaching out to us and saying, this is what's happening here. Can you come out and point a camera at this? Can you come out and have it so I can share my story too? And I think that's coming through not because of how terrible this issue is or what we're doing, but I think it's that we're doing something a little different, where we're not just going in and recording these stories and asking these communities questions and packing up our things and leaving. We're not parachuting. We're here to invest time in these communities to build real relationships.
So now, what would you like our listeners to do? I'll tell you what I'd like our listeners to do and why I invited you on the show. First of all, this is a personal issue, what's happening to you and your family. And when I saw the little film with five or six testimonials by ordinary people, I would say most of them were low-income people, and I'll get to that question in a moment. But their sincerity, their passion for someone who's an old hand like me, their political purity was very appealing. And when you watch them speak, and you very wisely shot them in their neighborhoods so you could see what was really happening, you got a feeling that this is an organization that I would like to call, me personally, because of those towers that I mentioned to you on Fox's property, which is right around the corner from me. I used to work at Fox, as a matter of fact, and I didn't realize then that they were poisoning the environment. I just thought they were underpaying me, and that was their worst fault. But getting back to this now, seriously, what would you like our audience to do? Would you like our listeners to be in touch with you if they have such a problem? Would you like them to be in touch with you if they are sympathetic about such a problem, if they just want to join you, help you, or perhaps give you lots of money so that you can finish this film? What are your motivations?
Well, I mean, money for the film would be great, but what actually motivates us to do this, in the end, whatever comes of this project, whatever comes of the film, the idea of Live from the Frontlines is to use anything, whether it's resources, connections, proceeds from this film, whatever it is that this project ultimately brings us the capacity to have, we want to give all of this back to these communities and to continue to help the great work of these local organizations. And these local organizations are organizations that work on the front lines every day. They're the most knowledgeable of these issues, and they're probably doing more work than a lot of these statewide groups are. And they don't get the same attention. They don't get the same funding potential. And, you know, this is really where I think the ultimate drive of this whole thing is to really empower these communities to continue the amazing work that they've already started.
Now, you know, at the meeting that I went to where I saw a little bit of your film and was so impressed with it, people spoke about the fact that they also wanted volunteers just to join you. You know, people who do the same kind of investigating you do, who find other victims who are in trouble because of what's happening to them locally and so on. So if my listeners want to contact you, Damien Luzzo, tell us, how do they do it?
Well, you can email me, Damien@livefromthefrontlines.org. And if you are looking for a way to be actively involved with what's happening locally, what's happening statewide, to a greater scale than just a documentary film or the kind of work that we're doing, I really encourage folks to really plug into local organizations and other groups that are working on these issues, like Stand LA, Stand Together Against Neighborhood Drilling Los Angeles, doing a lot of great work on the issue of neighborhood drilling, as well as Food and Water Watch, and a lot of great groups in the Central Valley who are also working on issues like pesticides, which is a very intersectional issue when we're talking about fossil fuel pollution.
There's a lot of reach out that happens on these organizations, particularly when they're young and when they have the kind of passionate leadership that you have and the emotionally involved membership that you had. When you have the kind of personal experience that Nayeli has, you really feel a kind of passion that gets something going. So I have a lot of faith in the future of the organization. And you spell your name Damien. So if you're interested, my listeners, you go to Damien@livefromthefrontlines.org. Before we leave, Nayeli, we understand that you're involved in something called Setback Limits. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so a lot of my activism focuses on fighting to establish a 2,500 health and safety buffer zone between oil extraction and sensitive land. And any sensitive land is schools, hospitals, residential areas, anything like that. And we really do that because there's no existing setback limit right now in the city of Los Angeles. And there have been studies done that if you're closer than 1,600 feet, I believe, you can get certain illnesses. You have a higher risk for developing cancer. For females, we have a higher risk for damage to our reproductive systems, and that's something that's not okay. Everybody has the right to breathe clean air despite their age, gender, ethnicity, or socioeconomic status. And it's not okay that it's 2019 and we're still fighting for that in low-income communities of color. So the buffer zone, if we get that, when we get that, actually, it would close about 86% of the oil wells in the Los Angeles area because of how close they are to homes.
Well, that sounds like it has an impact, again, on people of modest means. They're the first ones to suffer from all of these things, including defense budgets that are $700 billion a year. The president talked about that the other night, only to be raised to $716 billion this year. So this country has to get out of the habit of thinking that war is priority number one. We're thinking what you're doing is priority number one, and that is saving the planet. So Nayeli Kobo and Damian Luzo, thank you so much for joining us and for being pioneers in this excellent organization.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We should add that Nayeli Kobo won her fight against Allen Company. Allen Company has been temporarily shut down for 5 years now, but they continue to fight to reopen their facility and resume operations. As soon as Allen Company ceased their operations, all of Nayeli's symptoms went away. The only thing she lives with now is asthma and any other issues that may come up in the future. If you're interested in Live from the Front Lines, this new organization that really can go to very dynamic and important places, go to livefromthefrontlines.org and get more information. And now let's talk about another grassroots effort with good results. The teachers' strike 2 weeks ago, a display of labor's power when they really grab the reins and run with it. With us now is Jackie Goldberg, former head of the Los Angeles School Board, former assemblywoman, one of the most effective progressives in our community. And she is now running for the school board for the second time. Jackie Goldberg, thank you for coming on once again.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
And we're very excited about your upcoming election. We understand that the mail ballots have gone out.
They're not all out yet, but they're starting to go out, yes.
And when is the actual election?
March the 5th.
March the 5th. Tell us once again what you're running for.
I'm running for the Board District 5 seat on the Los Angeles Unified School Board. It's a vacant seat because the previous person, the charter candidate, Ref Rodriguez, had to resign because of accusations he pled guilty to of money laundering. That left the seat open. And so there's a special election on March 5th to fill the seat.
I think that the listeners would like to know why it's so important that you, a progressive, are the person who wins that seat. Describe the board to us.
Well, the board right now has three members who have been elected with about $10 million of funding by the California Charter School Association. And they seem to be focused primarily on 20% of the students. And the other three board members include two who have endorsed me. That would be a board member Schmurlson and board member McKenna. And they are three members. And then there's Vladovic, who didn't endorse me. So it's a 3-3 board, and my goal is to try to bring some balance to the board so that we don't have four votes that are run by people who are indebted to charter school contributors.
Now, you know, Jackie Goldberg, those of us who are on the outside no longer have children, you know, who have that problem. My children, for example, have graduated from college quite a while ago. But for those people who do, they're having trouble finding any consistency among charter schools. And you and I have discussed that before. Describe to us, what are the requirements for a group of people to open a charter school?
They must fill out a charter application. And the charter application requires them to say how many students they will serve, what their goals are in terms of academic achievement for their students, what their disciplinary policy will be, why they are doing this. There's a application form for a charter that's a part of the statewide legislation. But once you've submitted that application, school boards have no choice but to approve it if you have dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's. That is to say, if you answer all of the questions that are required in the document, then no school board can turn your charter down.
So in other words, it's a very easy thing to open a charter school. Do they have requirements that involve, let's say, science labs or music courses or art courses or libraries?
The requirements are basically that if the teachers teach the four key academic subjects, math, science, English, and history, they have to be credentialed. Other people do not have to be credentialed. In some cases, they can opt out of paying into the state teacher's retirement fund, which is undermining some of the pension funds. They can also not offer courses, really any courses they don't want to offer. Lots of them, for example, don't offer any special education services, so that's how they can reduce the number of special education children that come to their schools. Some of them, on the other hand, are very open to special education. It is a wide variety. You do not know what's going to happen just because they are called a charter school, because there are very few requirements other than the ones I've mentioned and that they give the state end-of-the-year test to all their students. That's really pretty much it. Other than that, that's what charter schools get. They get a pass to do really anything they particularly want to do.
Now, the question is this. Why would Eli Broad, you know, a billionaire or a trillionaire, whatever he is, you know, a wealthy man like that, his children also are grown. Why would he be interested in being a powerhouse when it came to charter schools? Why?
I'm not sure, but I will tell you there's a lot of money to be made in charter schools. Now, let me first say to you that a parent who makes a decision to put their kid in a charter school is not the problem, because that's a choice that they can make, and it's there. And if the underfunding of public schools continues and the charter schools end up with lower class sizes, lots of parents will pick a charter school, and that's not the issue. The issue is that right now there are so few rules, for example, on conflict of interest, so that a person on a charter school board can actually rent a building that they own to that same charter school at any price they want. They do not have to put things out to bid. They do not have to have competitive bidding on contracts for food services or anything else. So what basically the billionaire privatizers want to do is to say that there's $1 trillion spent on public education, K-12, throughout the country every year. $1 trillion, that's a lot of money. And they're the same people who want to privatize Social Security. They believe that there should be a way to make a market and profits out of virtually everything. And that's what they want to do with public education. Now, don't confuse that with many people who have started charter schools because they care about kids and they want good things to happen to them. And they think this is an opportunity to provide opportunities that the district is unable to provide and so on and so on. So it is a very complicated situation. And basically, the billionaire privatizers use the underfunding of public schools in California to try and find ways to get parents to help them privatize public education without realizing that the impact of their decision may be to undermine the education of 80% of the students.
But it just sounds more and more like charter schools are like private schools, which vary tremendously in the same way.
Well, they are private schools. They're just paid for by public
silly
money.
Well, that's an outrage. Now, Jackie Goldberg, you were part of the strike. And the strike was very inspiring to a number of progressives because it showed the strength of labor when labor hangs together. And we do have the impression that overall the strikers won the strike. What's your impression?
Absolutely. Absolutely. First of all and foremost, they got rid of what was called a Section 1.5. Section 1.5 in the old contract permitted the school district to ignore anything it negotiated with the teachers on class size. All they had to do is say, gee, we don't seem to have the funds or the ability to change this, so guess what? Even though we negotiated with you in your contract a class size of X, we don't have to follow that. So that's gone. So now every time the district negotiates class size with the teachers, that has to be the actual maximum class size of any classroom. This is a big, big, big deal. In addition to which, the district said, yes, we will, by the end of a couple of years from now, have a full-time nurse in every elementary school. In a couple of years from now, we will have a full-time librarian in every middle and high school. We will have the ability to provide an additional teacher per school this year, and then a couple more next year, and a couple more after that. And we are not touching the health benefits of classroom teachers and UTLA members or their retirees. They got a 3% and then a 3% raise. That's a 6% raise. That begins to make up for the years during the Great Recession in which they got nothing or even a cut in salary. So there were big gains. Now, here's some of the things people are worried about. The district required a reopener. That means that even though the contract is signed and closed, they can ask next year to talk to the UTLA representatives about retirees' benefits, about health benefits, about retirees' health benefits into retirement, that they can reopen on the whole question of health benefits for new employees as well as retirees, and new pension rules for the new hires. So there are dangers amidst good things that have happened. But the UTLA has also got reopeners on the question of class size and on the question of working on helping to deal with the questions of salary in the future. So there are some dangers, but mostly UTLA got a tremendous amount, given that the position of the board majority and the school superintendent was is that they had no money for anything, and that disaster was around the corner. But really, now the struggle goes not just from LA Unified to make sure that they carry out what they agreed to, but also now to Sacramento, because, you know, we are 43rd in what we spend in per pupil expenses. This is from Prop 13 in 1978, and it's also from Jarvis and Gann's amendment that said that it takes a two-thirds vote to change the taxes. So now the struggle will take all those parents that supported the teachers and other school district educators, and we're going to take it now to Sacramento and say to them, okay, we in the blue wave, we gave you two-thirds vote in both houses. Now it's time to tax the wealth of the state, because this is the fifth largest economy in the world after you say the United States, China, Japan, and Germany. If California were a nation, we'd be the fifth wealthiest nation in the world. And there's really no excuse for us not being in the top one or two every year in how much we spend on our children. So that's the next battle, and it's part of why I'm running, is to help lead that battle. I think that I'm the right person to do that, which is, of course, why I think that this is an important election.
So, Jackie Goldberg, you've explained it to us very well. The things that the teachers did not win sound very mean-spirited on the part of the negotiators. And one hates to hear that, you know, the pensions are in danger, the health care of teachers is in danger. Very petty. But what you did win was great for the kids and great for the teachers who are working now. So congratulations. I know you played a big part in that. And tell us again, one more time, when is Election Day?
The election is March the 5th. Absentee ballots are now beginning to arrive in people's homes if they are a permanent absentee voter. Though not everybody's gotten them yet, but they began mailing them on Monday, and they will keep coming until everybody's gotten theirs. People who get their sample ballot have until February 26th to request an absentee ballot, if that's what they want. There's only one item on the ballot, and that's this election. So you're going to have to find my name, Jackie Goldberg, in the 10 names that are on the ballot. And remember to mail it back in if you vote absentee or go to the polls on March the 5th.
Very, very good advice, Jackie Goldberg. Good luck with the election. That would be good luck for you and good luck for us.
Thank you very much, and thanks for giving me a chance to talk to you again.
Anytime.
Let's change the world to a better place, with air we can breathe, clean water and space. A world without war, a world without race. Let's make the world a much better place.
And that's our show for today. We thank our guests, Nobel Peace Prize nominee David Swanson, leaders in the new grassroots environmental group, Live from the Front Lines, Damian Luzo and Nayeli Kobo, and candidate for the Los Angeles School Board, Jackie Goldberg. Our theme, Let's Move the World, was written by me and performed by Keaton Simons. You can find it and his own great music on iTunes, YouTube, and KeatonSimons.com. Connect the Dots was edited by Mark Maxwell, whose great jazz show, Rise, is on Sunday nights from midnight to 3 a.m., much better than sleeping. Connect the Dots was created, produced, and hosted by me. I'm Lila Garrett. And we'll be back next week when once again we'll attempt to connect the dots. Until then, remember, the arms industry has neither friends nor enemies. It has only customers.
Black history happens every day in L.A.
The Los Angeles Centennial Newspaper, a weekly periodical aimed at black readership, was founded in 1933. In 2004, the Centennial was purchased by businessman Danny Bakewell, a man who has exerted his influence in so many ways in the greater Los Angeles area, always a civil rights advocate. He co-founded the National Black United Fund and became president of the Brotherhood Crusade. As chair of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, formerly the National Negro Publishers Association, his voice is still heard loud and clear across the face of America. As